the theme song that was at the center of must-see TV for much of the 90s. A TV show that made billions of dollars for Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David, and millions of dollars for Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Michael Richards and Jason Alexander, and not to mention NBC and its affiliates around the country, and a lot of people around the country who it made very, very happy. That show has now been turned into a book called Seinfeldia by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. The subtitle of it is How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. She's here to talk about it. Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. I really enjoyed looking through this, and it reminded me about some great stories from the book. And I want to play for you one clip from what I consider to be one of the all-time classic Seinfeld episodes, because I know you know the backstory on it. Here we go.
Wonderful.
The sea was angry that day, my friends. Like an old man trying to send back soup in a deli. About 50 feet out, and suddenly the great beast appeared before me. I tell you, he was 10 stories high if he was a foot. As if sensing my presence, he let out a great bellow. I said, "Easy, big fella." And then, as I watched him struggling, I realized that something was obstructing its breathing. From where I was standing, I could see directly into the eye of the great fish.
Mammal.
Whatever.
What did you do next?
Well, then, from out of nowhere, a huge tidal wave lifted me, tossed me like a cork, and I found myself right on top of him, face to face with the blowhole. I could barely see from the waves crashing down upon me, but I knew something was there. So I reached my hand in, felt around, and pulled out the obstruction.
A hole in one, huh?
One of the classics with George Costanza as a marine biologist finding the golf ball that Kramer had hit into the ocean and it landed in the blowhole of that whale. So what's the backstory on that scene, Jennifer?
Oh, that is definitely one of my favorites. Really, really wonderful. So That was sort of a scene that they added at the end of production of the, you know, show. They had made that episode, and they kind of, they realized they hadn't quite stuck the landing yet. So they wrote that really quick. They wrote, you know, it, which makes sense. It's really a monologue, you know, and gave it to Jason Alexander, who apparently has quite a good memory. He can memorize lines fairly quickly. And he just completely nailed it. It's really one of my favorites because I think it shows what a great actor he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you say that he had to do it quickly, they literally went off and wrote it in an hour or so and came back to him and said, "Here you go. We're going to have to record this very, very soon." And he really, really nailed it big time.
Yeah, I love that one. I always say if I needed a monologue to do an acting audition, that's what I'd want mine to be.
Thinking back on the show, you can't imagine anybody else being Kramer. You can't imagine anybody else being George. You can't imagine anybody else being Elaine. And, of course, Jerry had to be played by Jerry. Who else was considered for those other three roles, though?
Yeah, there were a variety of people kind of floating around. And isn't that always so satisfying? There's something so strange about those stories that makes us, I don't know, we love it. But everybody, there were a bunch of actors who read for the George role, including Steve Buscemi and David Alan Greer. And for Elaine, people like Megan Mullally, who ended up on Will and Grace later and was amazing.
Yep.
Rosie O'Donnell was considered. And yeah, it's just that strange thing where you're like, no one else could really, you just can't imagine it. But, you know, it would have been a very different show. And who knows, maybe it would have been equally great in a totally different way. But these success stories are all about luck and timing.
I don't think it's anywhere near as big a success if you have Steve Buscemi and Rosie O'Donnell as George and Elaine opposite. I mean, even keep Michael Richards as Kramer. And by the way, I have to ask you about Kramer because I know he's based on a real life guy who was Larry David's neighbor in an apartment building in New York, right?
Absolutely true. Yep. He, there's a guy who calls himself the real Kramer because he is. he lived across the hall from Larry David when Larry was creating the show. And Kenny would often, they had a very similar relationship to Jerry and Kramer, where they kind of kept their apartment doors open and would walk in and out of each other's apartments, which I think is kind of nice and cute. You know, it's like they didn't live together, but they had this camaraderie. And Kenny would wander in and out when Jerry and Larry were creating the show. So he was around for a lot of that early stuff. And he is very much like the Kramer on the show. He's very eccentric, big personality, and they wanted to use him, and they tried to come up with a different name for him, but they loved the name Kramer so much that they ended up striking an agreement with him to essentially get the rights to his name so that, you know, he felt okay about it.
That's perfect for the Kramer character, you know, getting yeah. paid to use his name. Although I know that in the pilot it wasn't Kramer, it was Kessler.
Yeah, you can hear it. There's like one time you can hear the vestige of that old name. They went through a whole bunch of different names in the script. And yeah, and it's impossible to explain, right? Like, you can't explain why Kramer is better than Kessler, but they have a real, their kind of comedy is very sort of sound oriented and rhythmic as much as anything. And they couldn't get off the Kramer idea. So they gave him a different first name, which we learn way into the show, of course. They gave him the first name Cosmo, which is a little crazier than Kenny. But Kenny is a fun, wonderful human being who still kind of, you know, makes part of his living giving bus tours of Seinfeld sites in New York City.
Of course he does. And by the way, the name Kenny Kramer or Cosmo Kramer is funny because it has the K sound, which Neil Simon once explained is the funniest sound in the English language. It's why cucumber is funny and tomato isn't.
Yep. And that's the farthest we can get to explaining that, right? Like, you can't explain why that's true. It just is. There's something about, I'm sure linguists could tell us, but, you know, it's really true. Tomato's not funny.
In the book Seinfeldia, Jennifer, you talk about the origin story of the show, and I don't want to go into that right now. I want people to be able to read about it in the book, but I'm very curious about the network and its role and its interference in the show, or its hands-off attitude towards the show. I know towards the beginning they could not have been thrilled that they had this holding deal with Jerry Seinfeld, and he wanted to put the show's future directly in the hands of his friend Larry David, who had no experience running a TV show, right?
Exactly, yeah. They were fellow comedians. They worked the New York stand-up circuit together. Larry had no experience even writing really television shows, much less running one. So that was a little nerve-wracking for them at first. And, you know, you mentioned, like, both sides of it, right? It's like the network was actually extremely generous with this show to a large extent in a way that I don't think we normally see. They kind of got that there was something there. They couldn't quite figure out what it was. They didn't think America was going to like it. But they also gave it a chance, you know, and I mean, not a big chance. The first episode it was one episode in the middle of July. Not July 5th, in fact, day after a major holiday. Like, not a great vote of confidence. And then they made 4 episodes the next season, and then they made 13. So it was a slow build that NBC gave to it. But in a lot of ways, they were extraordinarily hands-off, and sometimes they didn't understand what Larry was doing, but they let him do it anyway. And it's really a huge reason the show was so special and did what it did, is that it came up through the late-night department, which didn't know how to develop sitcoms the normal way. so they were like, we'll try this. And it's great that they did that because it really worked out.
In fact, you say in the book that it's going through that late night department and a guy by the name of Rick Ludwin, that he actually worked some money out of a Bob Hope special. They pulled a Bob Hope special off the air so that Seinfeld could be produced.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite facts. And what's great about that is, so that's one Bob Hope special, right? So that's 2 hours. That gets some four episodes of sitcom. Because that's a half hour each.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a brilliant little move, really, because it's like, oh, Bob Hope has so many of these things you'll barely notice. But this will get these people four episodes, which is better than one episode that they had the year before. So that's why it has that strange season where it's only four, because that's essentially the equivalent of a Bob Hope special.
Now, Hope was really old at that point, and his specials had become lame a couple of decades before then. But did he have to give the okay, or did he even know?
They did. There is mention of them calling to tell him. I never heard of any blowback on that. So it seems, I like to imagine Bob Hope, you know, at that point doing okay for himself and being like, great, one less thing for me to do, you know. I think it worked out okay in the end, though. I'm sure it wasn't like anybody's favorite thing to call up a huge star and tell him, like, hey, we're going to just give this kid at the time a chance, new kid Seinfeld. But I think we should really also recognize Bob Hope's little footnote role in one of the greatest sitcoms of all time.
Talking with Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, her book is called Seinfeldia. There's a great story in there about Jason Alexander getting the first script, and while he thought it was clever, he didn't think it was really going to be for anybody but him to watch, because he was right in the demo. But also, he was surprised at something that was missing in the script, wasn't he?
Yes. I'm fascinated by this. So we mentioned how Larry David didn't have a lot of experience, well, any experience with writing sitcoms. And so he didn't sort of have the traditional training. He didn't realize that he should give them, like, stage directions to do while they're saying the dialogue. He was a stand-up. What do stand-ups do? They stand up there and say stuff. So he knew how to do that. So lots of witty dialogue, no stage direction. So it's actually one of my favorite things to do in those, well, in any of the episodes, but certainly early ones, to watch the actors, because they had to kind of figure out themselves how to occupy themselves. You can't just stand and talk like you're not giving a monologue. So, you know, they'll look through magazines on Jerry's coffee table, or screw around with a, you know, bottle of Snapple or whatever, so that there's something for them to be doing while they're having these conversations that are so funny.
And they had to come up with that business themselves?
Yeah, that's kind of there's not an improvisational aspect to the show, but that's, you know, that's the improvisational aspect, because it really, you know, when they first pitched the show to NBC, they did say the show is two guys talking. And the thing is, that can't actually be a show, because TV is a visual medium. And what's funny is, I think the show becomes one of the most visual, action-oriented shows on television, especially with the brilliance of Michael Richards as Kramer, you know, the entrances and exits and things like that.
Yeah, and by the way, if we're speaking about physical bits, we got to include Elaine's dance moves, which came, what was the inspiration for that?
This is kind of exciting. This is one of my big scoops in the book. A lot has been written about Seinfeld, so it's exciting when you get a little scoop. So the writer of the episode, Spike Ferriston, his first job in New York City after college was that he was an assistant at Saturday Night Live, and he worked for Lorne Michaels, who was a giant in television comedy, and he was terrified of him. So, you know, he's answering the phones and, like, can barely speak to him, like, Mr. Michaels, you have a phone call, oh my God. And then one of his other jobs one day was to man the door at the Saturday Night Live after party. And this was a big deal in New York City, you try to get into this party. So he looked over, and as he remembered it and recalled it to me, he saw Lorne Michaels dancing with Sinead O'Connor at an after party, which I love, very 90s image.
Yeah.
And he claims that is how Mr. Michaels was dancing, the way that we now know as the Elaine dance. And he loved this because he respected Lorne Michaels so much and was so scared of him, but he said it was sort of humanizing. You know, it was like,
yeah.
From then on, he was like, oh, he's just a guy.
Yeah, and by the way, we're going to immortalize you in this dance that Julia Louis-Dreyfus is going to do as you. Perfect.
Right.
All right, the book is called Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, a great pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for your time here today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.